We are beginning the book of Obadiah. And technically, the book of Obadiah is a prophecy which is one chapter. You know, the Christians didn't even see fit to divide it to more than that. The book of Obadiah is a relatively short prophecy. And the book of Obadiah does not identify to us who Obadiah is, when Obadiah lived, where Obadiah lived. Obadiah is giving prophecy about Edom. His focus is about Edom. And we have a tradition, Chazal tell us, that this is the same Obadiah that was the top servant in Ahab's house. It was the same Obadiah who hid 100 prophets while Ahab was assassinating all the prophets. And the same Obadiah who Elio meets up with him and says to him, I'm now going to appear to Ahav. And Obadiah says, but I've been a God-fearing person from the time of my youth. If I go tell Ahav that, when Ahav comes to see you, God will take you off and you'll be gone. And Ahav will think I made fun of him and he'll kill me. Don't do that to me. And Elio says, no. This time we're going to meet. And then they have the face-off on Har Carmel. The same Obadiah, whose wife is the poor widow that comes to Elisha and says, my husband went into debt, took a loan from Ahab's son in order to maintain the prophets in the cave, and now I am impoverished, and Ahab's son is coming to take my children as slaves because he gave us loans with interest, and what will I do? And then Elisha tells her, well, what do you have in the house? She says, I have oil. Elisha says, start pouring, and the oil will just keep pouring. That is Obadiah's widow. So that is the tradition we have as to who this Obadiah is. And we have one more point in our tradition. We have many more points. But on this, that Obadiah was a ger, that Obadiah himself came from Edom. And so Hashem said, I want to take a person who actually grew up in Edom and came to Judaism, and he will be the prophet about Edom, about the future of Edom. All of this is tradition. You look in the Navi Obadiah, and all it says is Chazon Obadiah, a prophecy of Obadiah. You read the text, and you don't have any indication when he lived, where he lived, and who he was. This is all tradition. This is the Masorah we have.
Can you say, Jared, why did he go to the northern kingdom when this is full of idolatry and nobody was from the Mitzvah?
Why?
I don't know.
He was a ger. Why did he go to the northern kingdom where nobody was from where Mitzvot and everybody did over the Zorah?
I don't know where he did his Giyu, how he ended up there. If it was so easy to transfer kingdoms, I don't know.
Is it okay to turn off the fan?
Sure. Okay, so let's begin. Chazon Obadiah, the vision, the prophecy of Obadiah. We have on tradition that there are 10 terms for prophecy, and Chazon is the hardest one of them all. Chazut Kasha Ugadli.
What is the hardest?
Meaning it's going to be a prophecy that's going to tell of bad things, of difficult things, the harshest, yeah. So Obadiah is going to speak to the people of Edom. He came from them. And then he lived in the house of Ahav and Izebel, our two wicked, wicked rulers. And he remained a good person. And he is going to talk to Edom, who are the descendants of Esav. Esav grew up in a house with two tzaddikim, Yitzchak and Rivka. Had a brother who was a tzaddik, Yaakov, and he went the other way. So Obadiah, who had all the bad influences in the world around him, and didn't have a backing, he was a ger. And yet he remained an amazingly kind person, is therefore going to rebuke his own people for their cruelty, his own people who are descendants of Esav, who was the exact opposite. He had the bad, and he had the family, he had the society, he had everything around him positive, and yet he turned out so negative. We have on tradition that whenever we speak about Edom, we are talking about Christianity. The Ran, the Ramban, the Abarbanel, many Rishonim explain this along the same lines, that the descendants of Esav, they went and settled in Rome. And they became the prime inhabitants of Rome, to the extent that they were the ones who were at the forefront of the development of Christianity. And that is why when we speak about Edom, we say we're talking about Christianity. Now, Ibn Ezra, in his commentary on Torah, questions this. But this is the way we find throughout Midrashim, and this is what we find throughout the Rishonim, that they understood that this is a reference to the future of Christianity. So the prophet is going to talk about Edom, and Edom at this time does not seem to be such a formidable opponent. Edom was a small nation at this time in world history. Be it Edom, the Edomites, be it the Romans, they didn't seem like any serious threat. And so Ovadia says the following: Chazo Ovadia ko amar Adonai Elohim le'Edom Shemua shamanu meyet Adonai v'tzir bagoyim shulach kumu v'nakuma aleha la'milchama. The following vision of Ovadia, so says Hashem Elohim, the one who brings justice to the world and kindness, to Edom. Shemua shamanu, we've heard. That's why the Navi has to speak about it as something that they've heard, because it is a recurring concept among the prophets, but it was something that the prophets spoke about and the people couldn't envision. They saw Edom as this tiny nation. And yet the prophets keep warning them, wait and see what Edom's going to do. Shemua shamanu, we've heard, meyet Hashem from God, that something's going to be with Edom. Vitzil bagoyim shulach, and the nations have gotten word. And here the question is, what is the prophet referring to? So, one understanding is that this is a reference to the great war that is going to be against Edom. The nations will all gang up on Edom. Another understanding is that this is a reference to the message that's going to be sent out throughout the Muslim countries to go and fight Edom. The Tzil Bagoyim Shulach, and a message has been sent throughout the nations, Kumu v'na'aleh aleh ala milchama. Kumu v'nakuma aleh ala milchama. Arise, let us go and stand against it in war. So there's going to be a great war against Edom. Everyone against Edom. It's interesting that there's also going to be a great war against Israel. Everyone against Israel. And in that war, Edom will participate. But ultimately, there will be a great war against Edom, and the Navi again doesn't tell us when all of this is going to happen. The word nakuma, and the word kumu, says the Rambam, could mean to stand steadfast. Nakuma doesn't have to mean to arouse. Nakuma could also mean to have stance, to have permanence. Anytime it says Hashem will arise, does it mean Hashem will physically arise? Or does it mean Hashem will stand steadfast, will stand his ground, so to speak? So the word nakuma, says the Rambam, the word kumu could also mean to give existence or to stand steadfast with something. So let us arise and stand steadfast upon Edom in war. Hine katon netaticha bagoyim bazuyata meod. God says, I've made you small among the nations. You are very scorned. You are mocked. You are not worth as much as you think you are. What is he referring to? So Chazal say that this pasuk is a reaction, so to speak, to Rivka and Yitzchak's conversation about Esav. Rivka and Yitzchak always call Esav Beno Hagadol, their big son. So here God says, in my eyes, you're small. In your parents' eyes, they always call him my big boy Esav. You're not the big boy. In my eyes, you're small. Bazuya tameod. I look down upon you. You don't have your own language. You don't have your own writing. And your king is not the son of a king. Now who does that refer to? Hashem says, you are small. And the simple understanding here is that at this point in world history, no one thought much about Edom. No one thought they would amount to much. And then, Zidon libecha hishiecha, shochini v'chagveisela merom shifto. It's because of your strong desire to rebel against God. That's what moved you. And because that desire to rule and to rebel was so strong, that's what really got you to greatness. Shochni v'chagvei sela. Shochni, you rest like shochen. V'chagvei sela, in the crevices of the high rocks. Merom shivto, up high is where you dwell now. You've made it. Edom, no one thought you'd amount to much. And look, you're conquering the world. Omer belibo mi yorideni aretz. And you kept saying to yourself, no one can take me down from here. If we apply this to the Christian church, then you could look at the history of the Christian church up until the declaration of the Jewish state and look at what they were saying all along. Look at us, we're just getting stronger and stronger and bigger, and look at them. They're only going lower and lower, and therefore that's an indication. God doesn't like them anymore. They're not the chosen people, and there's no stopping us. And this was their claim for the last millennium. You know, they spent the millennium saying this. That's why when the state of Israel was declared, so the Christian church adopted a stance of, we have nothing to say. Everyone kept asking them, how do you answer this? And they didn't know what to say, because this was against what they had been saying for a millennium. This just didn't fit in their books. And that's why they've adopted a stance where they're constantly trying to undermine our existence. In the time of Ben-Gurion, finally, there was a pope who agreed to come to Israel. So Ben-Gurion called Rav Nissim. He was the chief rabbi of Israel. And he said, meet with the pope. He's honoring us. He's finally coming. And Rav Nissim said, I'm chief rabbi of Israel. If the pope wants to come, I have an office. He can make an appointment and we can meet. And Ben-Gurion said, you're shaming us. You have a position of authority. Your responsibility is as representative of our religion to go and meet with him and give him honor. And Rav Nissim said, no, I have nothing to give him honor. He wants, I'll grant him the respect I grant any person who wants to visit my office. I'm not going to go and meet with him because he is the pope. And Ben-Gurion pleaded and applied every form of pressure under the sun. And Rav Nissim held steadfast. He said, no, we have nothing to be embarrassed about. We've done nothing wrong. And if he wants to meet with me, let him make an appointment and come to my office. And this is where it stood. And Ben-Gurion was fuming at Rav Nissim. And then, I don't remember the name of the pope, he came, stood at the Kotel, stood at Maris HaMachpelah, and gave speeches against Israel, and spoke about how we have no right to be here, and we've always been afflicting, and how everything we've done is wrong. And he spent his time in Israel giving speeches all over against us. And to the point that when he left the country, he didn't even say goodbye to Ben-Gurion. After he flew out from somewhere in Europe, he called and said thank you to Ben-Gurion for his stay. And after Ben-Gurion was ridiculed so by the Pope, Ben-Gurion came to Rav Nissim's office and kissed him and said, you were right. You're the only one who saved the face of the Jewish people, because I put my head down to the Pope and you said, no, I got nothing to put my head down for. But throughout our history, they were saying just this. Who's going to bring us down? Just look, we're just getting stronger and stronger, and we are the future. And we spent the last millennium saying, well, we believe that's not the way it's going to end. And we had nothing to show for it, like David the Melech says, that we will spend a long period of time being ridiculed and mocked, and the nations will keep looking down at us and say, why do you keep believing? It says in the Song of Songs, the nations keep telling us, Shuvi, Shuvi, Ashulamit. They call us Shulamit, Shulamit from the word Shalem. I recognize you're holding your faith in God. But Shuvi, come back to us. Matechezuba Shulamit. What do you guys see in all this? Why are you always so interested in our joining you, we always ask. Why is that so important to you? And why do you think you have anything to offer us that comes close to what God is offering us? But they were always interested in bringing us to their camp. And this, the prophecy of Obadiah, we don't know exactly how to apply it. I'm suggesting an application, but that's always very dangerous. So just remember, what I'm saying is a suggestion. The Navi, what the Navi says is, literally, he says, the wickedness of your heart is what carried you. You wanted to attain a position of leadership and greatness, and that's what got you to the point of the high crevices of the rock. And you said in your heart, who can take me down from here? That's what it says. And so God answers Edom and says in Pasuk Dalet, In tagbiya kaneshel v'im ben kochavim sim kinecha. If you raise yourself like the eagle, and if you place your nest up among the stars, God tells him, Misham moridecha ne'um Adonai. I will take you down from there, says God. wherever you sit, as high as you think you're going to get, I will take you down from there. And you will be handed into the hands of the other nations. And there will be destruction wrought upon Edom from the other nations. Im ganavim ba'u lecha im shodede laila. If thieves have come upon you, if plunderers of the night have come to plunder you, eich nidmeita halo yignevu dayam. Why have you gone silent? Why have you been cut off? Why have you been so destroyed? The Navi looks in hindsight, so to speak, because he sees the prophecy as though it's already occurred. And over here, the Navi says, ordinarily, thieves only take what they need. They're not there to destroy the person they're stealing from. They're there to get what they want. So how come when you were robbed, you were destroyed? Im botzerim ba'ulach halo yashiru olelot. Even if people come to your vineyard and harvest your crops, they leave behind the grapes that aren't good. The olelot, the grapes that aren't good, ordinarily you leave behind. If you're stealing from someone, your purpose is to take what you want, not to destroy them. So how come ech nidmeita? How come you were completely destroyed? Eich nechpesu Esav nivu matzpunav. How come is it that by Esav, when it comes time for the destruction of Esav, they will search through everything and they'll try to get anything they can out of Esav? They will reveal every hidden place just to find anything that they could possibly take from him. That's not the way of thieves. Ad hagevul shilchucha kol anshei veritecha. You will go to war, and all the people who made all these peace treaties with you, they will accompany you to the border of your land, and then they will turn upon you, and suddenly you'll find that all the people that you assumed were in cahoots with your soldiers, suddenly they're going to turn on you in the middle of war. And this is really payback. In the time of the destruction of the second temple, we have on tradition that there were many, many Gerim from Edom. And when war broke out, they suddenly turned on us. And from within, they helped the destruction, they helped the Romans. It's interesting that after the destruction of the Second Temple, we have on tradition that there were tens of thousands of Gerim. There was suddenly a huge influx of people from Rome who decided to also become Gerim. We don't have a clear understanding as to why. But the Talmud says that people they thought the temple will be rebuilt. The Jews still have a future. You know, everyone has their ups and downs. And people started dedicating korbanos. Because during the time of the temple, a ger had to bring a korban. So you had tens of thousands of animals that were dedicated by these gerim who planned to bring the sacrifices in the future. And then the rabbi saw, hey, the temple isn't getting rebuilt so fast. You have all these holy animals walking around and people end up eating them and misusing them. So they said, no, you do your gear without dedicating an animal. When Mashiach will come or when we build the temple, then you'll dedicate and bring your animals. But your gear is not contingent on the sacrifice. In the time of the temple, it was part of the gear process. But after the temple's destruction, it wasn't. So from that Gemara, we see an indication as to the numbers, the tens of thousands that did gear after the destruction. So those, it seems, were true gear. But before the destruction, there were many Romans, many people from Edom who did gear, and when the war broke out, suddenly they switched sides. What?
Which war is
that? In which you said? I don't remember. Yes.
Were those Gerim that turned on us, were they the ones descendants of the... I thought I learned once that one of the Hasmonean kings turned on us.
Yeah.
He forcibly converted the Edomites.
Right, right. So it says that
Gerim,
they
were the ones that turned on us.
It was Gerim, yeah.
I mean, I think it's totally wrong that they turned on us, but I mean, I can actually understand
100%.
Better that they were forced to convert.
Right. It was in the days of Hurdus, not Hyrcanus, but in the days of Hurdus, that there are Edomites who joined, but I'm not sure if it were those that were forced converted. I don't know. The Malbim is the one that quotes this, and I don't know what his sources for it are. I don't know. Could be it's in Josephus. I don't know. Yes.
It's very strange that after the destruction, so many converts would come to Judaism. I mean, it just doesn't... tens of thousands?
Yeah, right. It leaves room to wonder, right? So, I could answer you in one of two ways, but they're both guesses. Okay. Meaning, they're historical guesses. It could be that... very often... Okay, we'll start differently. There was once a question that was raised here on a Thursday night. What can Bill Gates' daughter do to feel accomplished? This question one of the guys said. So I said that I think that the only way she can feel like she's done something in her life is if she dedicates it to the good of others. Meaning, if she tries to outdo her father financially, maybe she'll succeed. Probably not. If she tries to be the world super genius in other things, maybe she'll succeed, and maybe not. But if she can see the value of helping humanity and using the tools she's been given to be a positive person who can really affect humanity, then she will lead a rich and fulfilling life. Otherwise, she will find herself needing psychologists. She will constantly be in her father's shadow, and she will constantly have problems. Psychologically, she's going to have a very hard time. Now, I think the same thing might hold true in many circumstances. People think that being poor is a challenge. But the truth is that being wealthy is a bigger challenge. We have on tradition that less people succeeded with the challenge of wealth than succeeded with the challenge of poverty. Of the two challenges, wealth is a harder challenge. Even though it seems like it's an easier challenge, if you look around you, you'll see that the statistics are that... the wealthier people succeed less in the chinuch of their kids. They succeed less in the overall happiness of their families. It's a much bigger challenge. And it could be that after the successful military campaign of the Edom, the Romans, they stopped and reflected. And a lot of people started thinking, hey, wait a second, what's going on here? Like the famous story about the Nazi who was beating a Jew. And as he was beating him, he said, now tell me you're the chosen people. Tell me you still believe you're the chosen people. So as the Jew is being beaten to the dust, he looks back at him and says, well, one thing's for sure, you're not the chosen people. Well, this is a true story. And at some point, a person, sometimes after the dust has settled, a person looks back and asks himself, wait a second, what am I all about? And that's one possible answer. A second possible answer, which I don't know if it holds water historically, because we have a lot of questions about the calendar. Exactly when was the temple destroyed? And exactly when was Yeshu? And exactly when did Christianity start to spread? But if the concept of affliction was a big concept in world thought at that time, which I don't know if it was, so then it could be that a lot of the perspective was, well, look, they're suffering and they're smiling with it, or they're contending with it. And it could be that that was something that in world thought, as far as world philosophy, was very valued. A person who could suffer, like, grin and bear it. It could be that that was something that was very admirable. I know that in our half a century, in the last half a century, many, many people from Germany wanted to convert to Judaism. We have a much higher rate of people from Germany wanting to convert than any other country. There's something going on there where people are looking back at themselves and their parents and their grandparents, and they're asking themselves, do I really want to continue this way? I know what they did, or what they don't want to admit they did, but I also know what I see elsewhere. There are other possible thoughts, but at the end of the day, all of these are guesses. I don't know what they're worth. They're guesses. So the Navi continues and says, there seems to be an intent among the nations to destroy Esav. It's not only about getting the wealth of Esav. This isn't the classical case where one nation comes to steal from another, but rather they are trying to break you down, and the people who you've made a covenant with, the people who you trusted, and this is where we brought in the story of the Jewish history to show that this was midah keneged midah. This was, so to speak, like an eye for an eye, where God said, "Your gerim turned on the Jews. Well, you're going to find that the people who you had faith in are going to turn on you, and you're going to go out to the border. And then, when you're at the border, suddenly you'll find that the people who you thought you could trust turned on you, turned from within." Lachmecha yasimu mazot tachtecha ein tevuna bo. The Nabi says, Lachmecha, the people who ate your own bread will suddenly, they will suddenly attack you. You'll suddenly find that within you, they will turn on you and attack you, even though up until now you're the one that has been feeding them. And you ain't tivunabo, you won't have the understanding to realize that they're turning on you. Could you imagine a country that people are turning on it from within and it doesn't realize that that's happening? I don't know, I feel like I'm reading the newspaper here. Okay, I never like reading Nevi'im thinking that they're talking about today. But you read this and you got to ask yourself, if the ground zero, they're building a mosque. You know, I don't know what we're talking about here, but it certainly sounds like today's news. Hallo, bayom hahu, ne'um Adonai, ve'avati chachamim me'edom, utzvuna me'har esav. Hashem says, when that day comes, then I will remove the wisdom to know how to fight a war properly. I will remove the wisdom from Edom and the understanding from the mountain of Esav, where Hashem says they're going to be caught in their home territory. They're going to have problems. V'chatu giborecha teiman, and your brave people in the south of Israel, that's the source of Edom, they will suddenly be broken at the time of war. V'chatu, they will be broken. Giborecha, your brave soldiers. Teiman, you who originated in the south of Israel. Leman yikaretish mehar esav mikatel. To the point where the mountain of Esav will be cleaned of men, because they will all be cut down, they will all be killed. So there will be no man left on the mountain of Esav. There's going to be such manslaughter. Mechamas achicha Yaakov techasecha havusha. And this is all coming back to haunt you, God says, because of the way you treated your brother Yaakov, and therefore you will be covered with shame. V'nichrata le'olam, and you will be cut down for eternity. B'yom amodcha mineged, b'yom shivot zarim chelo. And what do I mean? Because there was that day when you stood on the side, and others, foreigners, were coming to loot the wealth of Yaakov. And the simple understanding is, he's talking about when Nebuchadnezzar came to attack, and Esav stood on the side and just watched as Yaakov was being destroyed. V'nochrim ba'u she'arav, and foreigners came to his gates. V'al Yerushalayim yadu goral gam ata ke'achad mehem. And this pasuk is always ringing in my ears. Ever since Barak went to meet with Clinton and Arafat, I have been thinking about this pasuk. V'al Yerushalayim yadu goral, and over Jerusalem they throw lots, and you too are like one of them. So the simple understanding is, he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem back in the time of the destruction of the first temple. But remember that this prophecy was written for eternity, because our sages saw that there's an eternal message in this prophecy. And here we have to wonder what that eternal message is. Yes?
And the Christmas speaking back about Teiman, you said that refers to southern Israel?
To the south of Israel, which is where Har Seir is. Mount Seir is...
It's not Teiman as we know today?
No. Teiman literally means the south. And the mountain of Esav was south of Israel.
So
So he's to comply with what David HaMelech wrote, I'll see you l'shpot et ha'isav.
Seems that way, yeah. ואל תרא ביום אחיך ביום נוחו ואל תשמח לבני יהודה ביום עובדם. You shouldn't have just watched as your brother was in a time of need, as your brother was in a time where he was being destroyed. Biyom nocho, you stood like a stranger, and don't rejoice over Yehuda when they are being destroyed. You shouldn't have partaken of that. You shouldn't have been happy at their destruction. Mal tagdel picha biyom tzara. And certainly you shouldn't have spoken in mockery of Yehuda, of Israel, at their time of affliction. You did all of this. When Israel was being destroyed and they were suffering, you just watched. And you just spoke in mockery. And you were happy at their destruction. Al tavo v'sharami biyom edam. Al tere gamata. The Navi says, and do not come to the gates of my nation on the day of their destruction. You shouldn't have come there to help the conquest in the period of the Second Temple. You shouldn't have looked on and seen how they're suffering. The people of Mount Seir, the neighbors of Israel, as Jerusalem was being conquered, they said, let us join in, let us also take from the loot. That's what Josephus tells us. So Hashem says, Al tere gamata b'ra'ato, don't you also come to look and partake of the bad that's happening to Israel. You shouldn't have done all of that. Dal tishlach navichelo biyom edo. And certainly you shouldn't have taken of his wealth on his day of destruction. Dal tamod al haperek lachrit et pelitav. And you certainly shouldn't have stood by the side and waited to see any Jews that tried to escape you would kill. That you certainly shouldn't have done. And here, again, the commentaries say this isn't only a reference to the period of the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. This is a reference to all of our history, where there were many people who stood on the sidelines and were willing accomplices to the destruction that was taking place. Ve'al tasgil siridav biyom tzara. And you shouldn't have given over the remnants that tried to flee on their day of affliction. Throughout the days of our history, we had situations where Jews tried to escape and people on the sidelines caught them and gave them in, be it during the Spanish Inquisition, be it during the period of the Nazis. There's a saying among the survivors that the Poles were worse than the Germans.
What do you mean by that?
There are many stories where the Polish were at least as cruel, if not more cruel, than the Germans. Either
the Polish nation, not people in.
Yeah, that's not to say there weren't righteous Gentiles. There were, but in general, there were a lot who hated us more than the Germans. That's what they say. I wasn't there. Ki kasher shititem al ha'kodshi yishtucho lagoyim tamid. Hashem says, just like you were by my temple, and you. Just a second, I skipped the pasuk, right? Pasuk tetvav. Sorry. Ki karov yom Adonai al kol agoyim kasher asita yeyaselach gemulcha yashuv beroshecha. God says, my day of reckoning is coming, and then you will be paid back in exact accordance with the way you behaved. You should have thought of this. That there will be a day when Hashem says, I will take you to task. And that day is set and ready and prepared. And there will be payback. Ki kasher shititem al har kodshi yishtucho lagoyim tamid. Hashem here turns to... here there are a few understandings as to what it means, shititem. One understanding is, shetitem is you rejoiced. over the destruction of my holy mountain, so too the nations will consistently rejoice over your destruction. Another understanding is that this is a reference back to the Jewish people. The Jewish people's destruction is often described as though they drank a cup of poisonous wine. So that's called in the Navi Kos Hatar Eila, the cup of poisonous wine. That's often how the Navi describes our destruction. So Hashem says, just as the Jewish people drank this cup of destruction on my holy mountain, so too the nations will consistently drink it. Vishatu vilau vehayu kilo hayu. And they will drink and they will become confused, and then they will become as though they weren't. Vayu kilo hayu, and it will become as though they weren't, as though they had never existed in the world. Uvehaltziyon tiyefileta vehayakodesh. But on Mount Zion there will be an escape. Whoever is on Mount Zion will remain. That mountain will be holy. It will no longer be defiled. And the house of Jacob will inherit all those that consistently inherited them. Uveit Yosef lehava, uveit Esav lekash, v'daleku v'hem v'achalum. And the house of Yaakov will be like fire as it burns the enemy. The house of Yosef will be like a flame, and the house of Esav will be like straw. And just like straw is quick to be consumed, that's what's going to be with the house of Esav. V'daleku v'hem, and they will light them v'achalum, and they will consume them. Melo yesarid lebeit Esav ki Adonai diber, and there will be no remnant in the house of Esav, because so God has said. And here Chazal say many interpretations in this pasuk. Why are we talking about Yisrael and Yosef? So Yosef is the one who he can take on Esav. We have a tradition that Yosef's children will not fall in the hands of Esav, and Esav will only fall in the hands of Yosef's children. That's the concept of Mashiach ben Yosef. It is the descendants of Rachel that have to take on Esav. And that's why when Yosef is born, Yaakov is prepared to take on Esav. It is the strength of Yosef. It's a different strength than any other strength in the Jewish people. And that's the strength that can take on Esav. Esav thought he'd marry Rachel. Rachel has special strength in the world. Rachel is mivaka al banah. She still consistently weeps over us. It's not bachta, it's not she wept, but rather mivaka. She consistently weeps. Rachel's grave is just between Yerushalayim and Beit Lechem. Yerushalayim is the center of holiness, and Beit Lechem is the opening to the other side. Rachel is in the middle, and Rachel can fend off for the harms that can come from the other side. So Rachel's children have a strength that no one else has. Yehuda, Mashiach ben David, he could lead us. It's a different concept, leading the Jewish people and taking on Esav. Two different things. Yes?
What I was curious is, does Esav, or say that even the Christian church have the opportunity to do tshuva? Like, it seems like in America, in some ways, that a lot of Christians, while they still have a lot of things wrong with their belief, but as far as like the attitude towards Israel and the Jewish people, like, it's not like it was. Is they doing tshuva? Or is this something that, at least in some way, they can escape?
I think tshuva is always an option. Hashem is always willing and wanting that people do tshuva. It's always.
I know for us as a people, like, we have a prophecy of judgment, and that can change. It's not set in stone. It's the same for the coin.
Every person has a choice where he will land.
I mean, like, as a people, not as an individual, but like, as like a movement, can this thing called Christianity change and like do tshuva as far as the Jewish people?
I don't know. You're talking about a whole movement. I don't know how that works. I don't see why not, but you know, I don't know. Every individual has an opportunity to change and has the responsibility to be a positive individual. Can a movement become a positive movement? I guess why not? You know, they could adopt the Noahide laws. I don't know if we could include some basics of their faith into the Noahide laws, so that would involve some radical change, but I guess why not? V'yarishu ha-negev et har Esav v'ashefela et pelishtim v'yarishu et sedei Ephraim v'et sedei Shomeron uvinyamin et ha-gilad. V'yarishu ha-negev, we just spoke about the house of Yaakov, so they will inherit the Negev, and he explains they'll inherit the mountain of Esav, which is on the south of Israel, and they will inherit the Shpelah, which is a reference to the territory of Plishtim, and they'll inherit the fields of Ephraim, and that's an area where they did not inherit. There was Amalek living there, and they only conquered the mountain of Ephraim, they never conquered the fields. So now they will conquer that, and they will conquer the fields of Shomron, and Binyamin will conquer Gilad territory. So you notice again, it's Yosef and Binyamin, the descendants of Rachel, that are doing the conquering here. The galut achilaze. So the Nabi is explaining who will be this army that is doing this. So the army is going to be the consistent of the people who came from all over. The people who lived with the Canaanim, and they lived in many different lands. The people who lived in Livnei Yisrael, Asher Canaanim Ad Tzarefat, Vegalut Yerushalayim, Asher Bisfarad, those from Jerusalem who live in Sfarad, which seems to be in Spain, they're going to conquer some of the territory. They will inherit the cities of the south. So the Navi is going down to the details that Jews from France, from Spain, from different areas, the Jews are going to come and help us conquer, take back the land of Israel and take back these territories. Ve'alu moshiim be'har Tzion lishpot et har Esav, and redeemers will go up on Mount Zion, and that is a reference to Mashiach, and they will bring judgment day upon Mount Esav. Ve'yetal Adonai hamelucha, and then God will have His kingdom, because at that point the nations will admit that Hashem's kingdom is true. So here, the question is, where over here is there a reference to Esav, and where over here we're talking about Amalek? It's a little hard to know because the censors changed a little bit what was written in the commentary. So it's hard to know where the commentaries really meant Esav and where they meant Amalek. Amalek was a descendant of Esav. It was Esav's grandson. He was the son of Eliphaz. Eliphaz, Esav's son, married Timnah, had a child named Amalek. So it's hard to know, but at any rate, Hashem says, "Vaital Hashem Amuchai will regain his throne," and we say that Hashem's throne is incomplete so long as there is evil in the world, so long as there is Amalek who denies, so to speak, Hashem's existence. So the recognition of Hashem's running the world is lacking, because you look and you say, "Wait a second. So why are they still here? Why are they so successful?" And Hashem says, after this war, so then Vaital Hashem Amuchai, Hashem, so to speak, will again have the throne, that the world will recognize that He is the one running the show. And this is the prophecy of Ovadia. Ovadia said this short prophecy about his own people, about the Edomites, and he spoke to them about their up-and-coming destruction. So Chazal described this as Minei Uvei Nalga, that when you want to take a handle for the axe to cut down a forest, you take a piece of wood, and so the wood, so to speak, turns on its brethren and then goes and is used to hack down all the other trees. So Chazal say, so too Ovadia is the one that's going to come and prophesy about his own people. But if we look at it maybe a little bit more deeply, then we can see this on two levels. On the one hand, once a prophet gives over prophecy, then it's closer to happening, as we've discussed many times. There's a decree in heaven, then it's said down below, and then you do an action, a siman, that's the beginning of its coming to fruition, and then it actually happens. So there's an order in which things come to the world. That's true. But also, we come back to Avram's point that there's always potential for tshuva. And in a sense, this prophecy is about destruction, but there's also a warning. The Nabi is telling them, don't do this. The Nabi is saying, don't be wicked. Don't watch idly as your brothers are being killed and tortured and exiled and destroyed. And we could understand it the way we kept understanding it, that the Nabi is referring to what they actually did and what they're going to be punished for. But we have to remember that there is also a warning here. And there is also a message to the nations. There will be a day of reckoning, and you should live your lives in accordance with that, with the recognition that God will take you to task for this. So the Nevuah of Ovadia doesn't only have to be viewed as a terrible prophecy about the destruction of his own people. We could also remember that there's also a warning for his own people. And the wording of the prophecy is also a wording of warning. Don't do it, guys, because you will pay for it. So we could also see it in a positive light, that the Nevi is also turning to his own people and saying to them, guys, remember, God will pay you back for your evil deeds, and don't do it.
So why?